From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Every year, the League of American Bicyclists ranks states on their bike friendliness. They look at things like infrastructure, education, and legislation that protects and promotes cycling. Well, last year, Utah got a D, ranking just 31st in the nation. But biking is increasing in visibility in the Beehive State. More communities are designating bike lanes and building trails. City planners are trying to integrate bikes into their master plans. And the University of Utah, traditionally a car-based commuter school, envisions a more bike-friendly campus. Today on the program, we're talking about pedaling as a mode of transportation and how to make room for bikes on the roads. Plus, a violin prodigy wants your online vote. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Six bicyclists are killed in an average year in Utah, and about 850 are involved in a crash with a vehicle. Those are sobering numbers for those who strap on helmets and hit the road pedaling, but still, more Utahns are using bikes to get from point A to point B. And today on the program, we're talking about thinking outside the car. We're talking about bike safety, bike trends, and what it will take to create a more bike-friendly environment here in Utah. Joining me this hour, Evelyn Tuddenham is the Bike and Pedestrian Coordinator for the Utah Department of Transportation. She joins us in studio. Evelyn, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. And also with us, Jonathan Morrison, Executive Director of the Bicycle Collective, which promotes cycling and provides refurbished bicycles and educational programs to the community. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
As well as Becca Rolfe. She is Bicycle Pedestrian Coordinator with the Salt Lake City Transportation Department. And Becca, thanks for your time today.
Hello.
Later on in the program, we are talking about a young violinist who needs your vote. But first, bicycling. If you're a bike commuter, how was it out there on the roads this morning? Why do you bike? And what more do you think can be done to promote safety between bikes and cars? If you have questions or comments, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Jonathan Morrison, I want to start with you. Tell us your bicycle conversion story. Why do you love riding a bike and encourage others to do so?
Oh, I don't know if I converted. It was just since I was a kid, I always loved to ride. There was something about two wheels that was just elegant to me, so ever since I was younger, I took them apart and put them back together, and as I got older, it didn't change.
Okay. How far do you commute on a daily basis?
From my house to the Bicycle Collective, about 3 miles each way, so it's about 6 miles.
And how much time a week do you think you spend in your car as opposed to on your bike?
I actually don't have a car.
Okay. There you go.
I have a motorcycle, just not a car.
Becca, tell us about your ride. What kind of bike do you hop on a daily basis?
I have a choice of several, but most often in the city, I find myself hopping on a 1975 Raleigh 3-speed. It's a classic bike. I also have a certain affinity for classic cars, I have to tell you, although I don't own one. I do like them. And so I hop on the classic bike, partly because those bicycles were from a time whenever bicycling was easier, more relaxed, there was less traffic on the road, and that's part of the lifestyle that I aspire to.
Mm-hmm. It's a lifestyle choice then for you. I mean, is that why you ride?
It is. The primary reason I would say I ride is because it makes me feel better. Personally, it's about health. It's about mental health, maybe even sometimes in the winter on those gray days. But it's mostly about health and physical fitness for me. There is a certain environmental component to it, but it's health, physical fitness, and a little bit of economics.
Mm-hmm. Let's expand on those. What are the benefits of biking, Evelyn Tuddenham?
Well, I think health is the very first thing that people think about when they think about biking. One of the other things that I think is really important is that the more people that ride bicycles, especially commuting to and from work, the fewer people we have in cars. It makes a little bit of a dent, and I think it makes a difference overall. It puts us in touch with the environment, and it puts us in touch with our physical selves.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the economic part of it, as gas prices go up, people are looking for alternatives.
Yes, and we see more and more of that as gas prices rise.
Why is the Utah Department of Transportation involved? Why do they have a bike coordinator?
Well, bicycle and pedestrian coordinators are actually required by federal law in all states. So Utah joins in that with the rest of the country, of course. And I think that the Department of Transportation also recognizes that bicycling and walking are viable modes of transportation, and so they need to be represented within the transportation mix.
What kind of commitment does UDOT have to providing safe environments to for biking and for walking?
Well, I think one of the things that we're doing now is we're doing a lot of collaboration with other agencies to really look at how we can all work together to build bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. And then another thing that we're involved in that's been very successful and quite high profile. The Utah Department of Transportation actually conceived of a idea called Road Respect a couple of years ago. And subsequently, we brought the Department of Public Safety in and Bike Utah, and they're now sponsoring the Road Respect campaign. And the centerpiece of that campaign is a tour of Utah that starts at one end of the state and then moves to the other end of the state. And as we go through the state, we actually stop in cities and towns and hold events where we talk about bicycle safety. And we kind of stimulate interactions between drivers and bicyclists so they can talk about how they can share the road more successfully.
I want to get to some of those safety programs in a bit, but biking is can be hazardous. There are people out there who it's difficult to find a safe place to ride. Most bike commuters that I know have a near miss or an actual contact story with a car. Jonathan Morrison, tell us yours. Do you have a near miss story, or have you been hit by a car?
I've been hit by a car, but it was thankfully about 12 years ago. So, and it was the car failed to yield and hit me. It wasn't in this state, but it was actually upstate New York. But all those happen too. I've also been in a fender bender when I was driving a car. So, you know, it really depends on, you know, there's no safe place, not even sitting on your couch when it comes down to it. So you kind of accept the fact that even my bike ride here, I was just smiling inside going, "Wee!" You know, those are the things that I try to focus on as a priority.
Do you worry about safety issues, Becca Rolfe?
I do, but I have taken the approach of becoming very informed about how to position myself on the road to be as safe as I can be. And I actually feel like Utah motorists are very respectful as long as I am being predictable. And there's a tension that enters whenever there's unpredictability in terms of what is that bicyclist going to do? And when you look at me riding down the road, it's pretty clear where I'm headed. I'm also very visible. I do wear bright colors. I try not to wear, I hesitate to say this, but geeky bike clothes. I try to wear brightly colored normal clothes because I'm mostly commuting to work. But you will notice that there are an abnormal number of red jackets as part of my professional wardrobe.
Becca Rolfe, she is the Bicycle Pedestrian Coordinator with Salt Lake City Transportation Department. Also with us, Jonathan Morrison, Executive Director of the Bicycle Collective. And Evelyn Tuddenham is the Bike and Pedestrian Coordinator for the Utah Department of Transportation. And we're talking about bikes, about bike commuting, bike safety, and how you think this community can be more bike friendly. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. This email from Cynthia in Salt Lake City, she writes, "I've been a bike commuter for over 3 years now, and for the most part enjoy the experience in Salt Lake and all of the bike lanes. I obey traffic laws, stop at lights, ride single file, and take bike lanes whenever possible. That being said," she continues, "I cannot go more than a week without being almost hit, harassed for bicycle in the road. I legally have a full lane but rarely take it, and having to get someone's attention that is completely unaware that I am riding near them. I love this city and we have amazing weather to bike in, but I wish people would look up from their cell phone and learn the laws." That's from Cynthia in Salt Lake City. Becky Rolfe, what do you think? Is Cynthia's experience common?
I think that from talking with many bicyclists, I think that Cynthia's experience is somewhat common. At the same time, I think that there are, I mean, I have to say, I rarely have these types of conflicts. And so I do think that there is sometimes a male-female element to whether you experience road rage as a bicyclist. And presumably Cynthia is probably in the same category as me on that one. So I think that there are perhaps things that bicyclists can do to become more predictable on the road and know how to position themselves. At the same time, it is definitely true that motorists have a responsibility to pay attention to what they're doing on the road. We do see that motorists are responsible for maybe a slight majority of bicycle pedestrian crashes in the area. And so paying attention is a vital part of operating a motor vehicle on the road. You really are operating something that can kill someone. You don't wave a gun around, hopefully, without paying attention to what you're doing. And similar is true with cars.
Evelyn, let's talk a little bit about the motor safety part of this equation, because there are two parties involved here, cars and bicyclists. There is a perception that cyclists don't obey the traffic rules. They run red lights, they ride on the sidewalks. How is UDOT trying to educate motorists on how bikes should be used on the roads, you know, what the rules are?
Well, I think the Road Respect Program is a big part of that. And one of the things that we learned as we were moving towards that program, we did a lot of research statewide to find out what the behaviors actually were out there. And one of the things that we learned is that motorists don't understand the rules of the road as regarding bicyclists. But we also found that a lot of bicyclists don't know what the rules of the road are. Now, we did our program last year. We had our ride in June, and we also did some follow-up with that as far as media campaign is concerned. And then we did some research following that, and what we found is that there was a higher awareness of a lot of certain types of rules of the road. For example, cyclists were much more aware of the fact that when they're impeding traffic, that they should ride single file. Also, motorists were much more aware of the fact that they needed to give cyclists 3 feet of space. But I think the important thing is one of the things that Becca brought up, and that is really being aware and paying attention. And actually, mutual respect on the road goes a long way. Drivers need to be aware of what cyclists are doing on the road. And we find that as more and more cyclists take to the road, drivers become more aware because they're more used to seeing them, and they understand better what to expect of cyclists, which is one of the things that Becca brought up, and that's very, very important.
Jonathan Morrison, your group, the Bicycle Collective, provides seminars, workshops on how to keep safe out on the roads. What are some of the tips that you advise cyclists to take into account before they strap on that helmet?
Well, I think one of the key things that Evelyn mentioned is really that mutual respect, first of all. And that's, you know, depending on what you're, most people have a car in their garage and most people have a bike in their garage. It really depends on what you're on at that time and what you use more. But the way to think of that is really we're all the same and it just depends on what we're using. Given that, if cyclists just think as a car, as mentioned earlier, that's one of the key factors. So what would a car do is what it comes down to. If a car wouldn't, you know, hop up on the sidewalk at a certain point in time, then you probably shouldn't either. And if the one common place that people can get injured is if you're going straight while a car is making a right-hand turn in front of you. If you were a car, you wouldn't be to the right-hand side of a right-turning car that's asking for an accident. You need to be in the left-hand side. And that's no exception with a bicycle. That's one misconception I think cyclists have is that they have to be all the way over to the right in the gutter with all the glass and the broken stuff. The reality is, like, you need to be as rightmost as you are safe, and that could be to the left of a right-turning lane. So the right-turning lanes are definitely a key, and just thinking like a car and being respectful, too.
I would say in general that intersections are the place that people most need to pay attention. And that's true whether you're on a bike or in a car. Most crashes do happen at intersections, especially in an urban environment. People are often kind of worried about getting hit from behind by someone coming up behind them. And that is actually a fairly rare crash type. So it's intersections where everyone needs to kind of be as careful as they can. Look for bikes along the side of the road if you're driving, and try to position yourself as well as you can for your direction of travel when you're on a bike.
It's that left-hand turn that gets me. But I'm always afraid when I'm riding along and there are cars parked on the right that somebody's going to open their door that won't see me. How common is that, Becca?
It's not particularly common as a crash type, but it is a concern. And staying outside of that door zone is definitely a smart idea. We try to design bike lanes in Salt Lake City so that they are wide enough so that bicyclists can ride sort of on the left-hand side of the bike lane and stay out of the door zone when there are parked cars alongside.
Speaking with Becca Rolfe, she is Bicycle Pedestrian Coordinator with Salt Lake City Transportation. Also, Jonathan Morrison with the Bicycle Collective and Evelyn Tuddingham with UDOT. And we're talking about bikes and how cars and bikes can peacefully coexist on Utah roadways. You can join us if you like. 801-355-TALK is our number. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. By one measure, Utah ranks just 31st in the nation when it comes to bike-friendly states. But don't let the tepid rating dissuade you from hopping on your two-wheeled chariot and taking a spin. More Utah cities and towns are widening roadways to accommodate bike lanes, and the state is boosting programs that encourage cycling and bike education. Today on the program, we're talking about the allure, the benefits, the safety aspects of biking in an urban environment. This hour with us, Evelyn Tuddenham is the Bike and Pedestrian Coordinator for UDOT. Jonathan Morrison is the Executive Director of the Bicycle Collective. And Becca Rolfe is Bicycle Pedestrian Coordinator for Salt Lake City Transportation. And we invite you to join us. Share your stories. How do you think cities and communities can better accommodate cyclists? If you're a driver, what would you like to see from those on bikes? And vice versa, those on bikes, what would you like to see from cyclists? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to the phones. Jamis from Salt Lake City has been waiting. Jamis, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm really interested in this, the topic. I've been a bike rider for probably two or three decades in Salt Lake. I'm visually impaired and haven't driven since I was a teenager. But I would ride the bike to work in a suit and in rain and snow. And several years ago, I took a bike and, you know, had the stem changed and put on high handlebars. I wanted to be sitting upright. I put on baskets. And I remember my daughter-in-law said I looked like, I looked odd, but I was glad to do it. And in the last couple of years, there's just been an explosion of bicycle traffic in Salt Lake, and it's been really very gratifying. I would urge that there really be some look at infrastructure. There are several cities that are really progressive. For one thing, for example, the garbage bins often block the bike lanes. There are efforts to put diamond squares in various intersections. Portland has made some specific streets bike only. There also is a notion of putting some concrete barriers a little bit to separate the bike lanes, because it's scary out there. I mean, we've all been close to being hit. But I'm really thrilled at this. I would like to see a little more, this sort of barrier, a little more attention paid to infrastructure. Just a painted line is really not quite enough to protect bicyclists.
Okay. Well, lots in there, Jamis. Thanks very much for the call. Becca Rolfe, barriers, infrastructure. What's Salt Lake City doing?
Yes, actually, that's a very good question, and we are going to be piloting a new design in Salt Lake City. That's exactly what James is talking about in terms of a more separated type of bikeway. On 3rd East, we are going to be doing a pilot project this summer, probably in June, that is going to take The parked cars and move them out and use them as a barrier between moving traffic and the bike lane. So the bicyclists will be against the curb. There will actually be a door zone buffer. And then there will be the parked cars separating the bikes from the traffic. And we are experimenting with this on a whopping two-block segment. And we also will have one block of a extra-wide buffered bike lane, just extra paint as part of the bike lane. And we are going to be taking a lot of feedback from the community in terms of what do they think of this design, how does this function for them. We're going to be asking the residents along the corridor, as well as the businesses along the corridor, as well as people riding their bikes, how does this work for you, and should we do more of it? So our goal there is, with our huge three-block project, we're going to be trying to determine what design we want to use more broadly in the city.
Okay. Evelyn Tuddenham from UDOT, what is happening in other communities throughout the state? When it comes to bike safety, those infrastructure issues, making sure that the bike lanes are designated, that, you know, what is the state doing to make sure that bicyclists stay safe?
Well, we're finding a lot of interest throughout the state in building bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. Specifically, bicycle infrastructure is very important. You know, one of the things that we understand is that it's important to have a system, a complete system that works for cyclists so that you can get from point A to point B on a bicycle and you can do it safely. And in order to do this, what we've come to understand is that we really need to work with local communities.
Do you find that local communities are embracing this sort of bike friendliness, or are people still a little bit, you know, we've only got so much money and this is not a priority?
Well, I think that funding is always an issue. But what we also understand is that if we work together on this, if we can collaborate, we're going to be much more likely to be able to come up with that funding when it's needed. And it also helps us to work together as a block to really identify funding sources. And one of the things that UDOT is doing right now is that we're working with UTA, in a partnership with UTA, Salt Lake County, Wasatch Front Regional Council, and Mountain Land Association of Governments, and also, interestingly, Rio Tinto as a private partner, on a project called UCATS, which stands for Utah Collaborative Active Transportation Study. And what we will be doing is looking at all of the bicycle and pedestrian plans along the Wasatch Front, and that's from Provo to actually Brigham City, looking at what is planned and then looking at how we can build on those plans and build particularly in connections to transit, so that we can start building bicycle infrastructure throughout the Wasatch Front and doing it in a cooperative way.
Mm. Jonathan Morrison, as someone who is dedicated to bikes and talks to a lot of bicyclists, what is on the minds of cyclists when it comes to infrastructure? What would you like to see to make it easier to get from point A to point B on your bike?
Well, you know, it's on one level, it's strength in numbers. If you look at the cities that everyone talks about, really when people are safer, it's just because there's more people riding. And sometimes it's even just a perception thing where it's like, oh, the city's safer and more people start riding. And all of a sudden there's just more visibility because there's more bikes. So that's something we strive for, is just to get more people riding.
You want to be the next Amsterdam?
In certain regards, maybe not others. But The other thing that I'm really excited about are those segregated barriers, because I live next to Liberty Park and you just see people going around in circles and around in circles, and man, that looks boring, because there's these great ways to get from point A to point B, and they're roads. And if there were these segregated lanes throughout the city, then people would feel that same comfort they do as they go around in circles as Liberty Park. But you know, in a more transportation A to B manner. So We're really excited about that. And obviously, you know, just more awareness between people who are riding bikes and people who are driving their car, just to, you know, be friendly with each other.
We're talking about the peaceful coexistence between cars and bikes. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go back to the phones. And Sean from Salt Lake City is calling. Sean, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My comment is a little bit, I suppose, to the opposite. I bike and I also drive. I'd like to just flip the tables for a minute. Yesterday, I was taking my kids to school. I live just at the base of Mill Creek Canyon. And I came to a stop sign and was turning left. There was a bicyclist coming down the canyon. There was plenty of room for me to make my turn. And I figured that they would probably slow down coming. They weren't even close to the intersection yet. So I started my turn. They did not stop. They didn't even slow down and came right into the lane, which caused me to swerve into oncoming traffic and created a really dangerous situation for me and my children, as well as them. Being somebody who bikes as well, I try to be very cognizant of those cars and bikes and who's around. So what's being done to educate cyclists that they do need to obey the rules of the road? And also not cause dangerous situations for motorists as well as for themselves.
Okay, so you have to get a driver's license in order to drive a car. What's being done to educate the bike community on how to be safe out there? We've mentioned a couple of things, but who wants to jump in?
Well,
Jonathan.
I think one reality, it's for example, the Bicycle Collective, we provide bikes to different charities, and we also provide them to different organizations, people that are trying to get back on their feet, like halfway houses. So one observation people make is like, oh, well, these guys are riding on the wrong side of the road doing this. And, you know, you have to recognize it might not be the first law they've broken, and it's probably not going to be the last. There's a certain section of the population that you are going to have a lot of trouble reaching, but it's not just with bikes. It's with a lot of things. And that goes for not only people riding bikes, but motorists as well. So, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt and acknowledge the fact that some people you're not going to be able to change their actions. But on the flip side, it can be an opportunity for law enforcement to provide warnings and kind of education in that regard. I know the police department's working on some of those things.
Becca Rolf?
And some of it, I think, is also personal responsibility and kind of a social culture phenomenon where I know when I'm a bicyclist and am stopped at a red signal, for example, and somebody else blows past me on the bike, I kind of wonder what they're thinking about why I'm stopped and they're going whenever there's a red signal. And I think that as more people stop, there starts to be a little bit of pressure that maybe that's the right thing to do. So I think some individual personal ethics about taking that responsibility of being on the road seriously and acting appropriately is part of it. Another thing I would say is that we do need to work on our infrastructures to make it so that it is safe and convenient for people to do the right thing. If we try to have bicyclists all stop at signals and they know that the signal is never going to detect them because there are wires in the road that detect where cars are stopped waiting for a signal. If they know that signal's never going to detect them and they could sit there for 20 minutes waiting for the light to turn green, they are going to run it. And so that's a responsibility on the part of those of us who design infrastructure to start to make it really work for bikes.
And did you have something to add, Evelyn?
One of the things that we found with the Road Respect Program is that, like I said before, we did our research and realized that a lot of people didn't understand what the rules of the road were pertaining to bicycles. So we actually put together some little cards that you can put in your wallet that list all the rules of the road for bicycles. And we have gone into multiple printings on them. We've distributed them to law enforcement agencies throughout the state and also to interested people. And I think we probably distributed around 60,000 so far, and we'll probably distribute that many this year. Mm. So it's just getting the information out there about what the law really is very, very important.
Mm-hmm. This is a somewhat related question from Kate calling from Cottonwood Heights. Kate, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yes, it is very much related. I grew up in England, and as a child, we had cycling proficiency lessons telling us how to use the road and how to signal and things like that. Living here in Salt Lake, I see an awful lot of cyclists cycling up the wrong way of the street or on sidewalks and not behaving like a propelled vehicle. A, it's not safe, and B, they're not part of the moving vehicle community, and I think that goes a long way to alienate them from drivers.
Kate, good point. Thanks very much for the call. Jonathan Morrison, you said you started biking as a kid. What is going on in terms of educating children on bicycle safety and responsibility on the roads?
Well, I mean, when it comes down to it, education, your biggest bang for your buck, and again, funding is always tight with all this stuff, but your biggest bang for your buck is focusing on kids, and that's in schools. And there's a great program called Safe Routes to Schools that allocates funding for basically a school can apply for it, and they have identified safe routes to get to the school. One problem we have is obesity is rampant, and our kids are getting bigger and bigger, and that causes its own set of issues. But on top of that, kids are being dropped off at the door by their parents. And the operational cost of a school bus is about $37,000 to $40,000 per year. Not capital cost, but operational cost. So if you just have all those kids walking and biking to school, it makes a big difference. So if a school can identify the primary routes that kids want to walk and bike to school, and then look at that route and say, oh, hey, there's this one part of it that really needs a crosswalk. There's this one part of it that really needs a light. In some rural communities, there's a huge part of it that just needs a sidewalk, period. So the Safe Routes to School is actually funding to address those issues and fix them. So it creates that infrastructure for children to actually do the thing that I fell in love with as a child, and that's ride your bike to school. Mm-hmm. And then, as they grow up, they're just better cyclists.
But the fact is that I believe the statistics from the state of Utah, the vast majority, I think it's over 60% of the car bicycle accidents are under 20, young people. Evelyn Tuddenham.
Yes, and one of the things that we've really tried to do is get to those kids and teach them the right way to ride a bike and how to be safe on a bike. There are bicycle rodeos that are available through health departments and law enforcement. Throughout the state, and if you get in touch with your local law enforcement, they can usually tell you, if they don't have the program themselves, they can tell you where to go to find a bicycle rodeo. And what they do is they come out and they work with the kids. They set up little tracks for them. They tell them how to make sure that their bicycle is safe and how to ride it safely.
Mm-hmm. A couple of emails I want to get to. This is Karen from Salt Lake City. She writes, there are many ways cyclists can contribute to their own safety. It would be especially helpful if cyclists would make themselves more visible at night, not with just a back reflector, but also a light, or at least reflectors in every direction. Becca, you're nodding your head on that one.
Yes, absolutely. Using lights at night is required by law in all 50 states to use a headlight. And actually, in an urban environment, more crashes tend to happen from the front. So it does make motorists more comfortable if you have a rear light in addition to a rear reflector. But it's actually that front light that's the most important, particularly when you're in an urban environment. Again, everything happens at the intersections. The more that you can do to be visible as you're approaching the intersection, the safer you're going to be. So Salt Lake City is actually going to be launching a campaign this summer to encourage bicyclists to use lights at night. And we will also probably be doing some light giveaways to people who we find out on the roads. We're not going to tell you where we're going to be, but we will be out there somewhere after dark on some popular biking nights, pulling people over and saying, hey, did you know you need this? And here is one. And let's help you put it on your bike right now so that you can be safe and legal.
Let's squeeze in one last call. Our time is dwindling, but Jim, very quickly from Salt Lake City. Jim, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live up Emigration Canyon, and there is a designated bike lane up and down Emigration. There is also a rule that says that bikers should be riding single file. And what I see all the time are bicyclists that ride in packs up the canyon that don't adhere to that rule, and they wonder why sometimes people who live up the canyon get a bit peeved at them not riding single file when they're supposed to be following that rule.
Okay, Jim, thanks very much for sharing that experience. Who wants to take it? Becca Rolfe.
I'll take it. That's actually outside of Salt Lake City, but I'm somewhat knowledgeable about that situation. And I think that there's a mix of things going on in Emigration Canyon. Yes, it is a very popular cycling route. Yes, people want to ride more than single file, especially if it's a social activity. And there are some places where that is probably safe to do so. It is actually not the law that you have to ride single file. As long as there is enough space that motorists can pass you safely. So there is a tension there, and there's the state law allows you to ride no more than two abreast. That is, you can ride two abreast as long as motorists can get safely by. So this is a situation where there really does need to be a little bit of give and take on the part of both bicyclists and motorists. Going downhill down Immigration Canyon, the bicyclists are often going quite quickly, and sometimes it's not safe to stay in the bike lane at that speed, particularly if there happens to be some type of debris in the bike lane. So sometimes it's understandable why bicyclists might not necessarily be tucked over on the side of the road where motorists think that perhaps it's better to be.
Evelyn, very quickly.
Just very quickly. I think that one of the things that we've got in Utah is twisty-turny canyon roads. And it's important for cyclists to really use their best judgment when they're riding on those roads. So when they're going around curves, they're aware that there are cars around and that they ride single file, particularly in curvy areas on those roads, so that they're safe.
A lot of emails from people wanting to know safe pathways. David wanting to know if he can ride a bike from the top of the state to the bottom without using the interstate. This one from Lanice in Sandy wants to know a safe path from Sandy to the University of Utah. How can people find out more information about trails, about safe bike lanes, all of that? Jonathan Morrison?
Well, if you're Salt Lake City actually does have a wonderful map that outlines all the bike paths inside of Salt Lake City. But when it comes down to, larger spans of travel, it's best to really talk to other people who have done it. And there's a good resource called cyclingutah.com that will link you to other organizations or folks that have traversed those places. Like the Bonneville Cycling Club is another great resource for people that have really toured all over the state. So just talking to people and being friendly is a great way to find out.
We're going to have to leave it there. Jonathan Morrison, Executive Director of the Bicycle Collective, thanks so much for your time today.
No problem.
Becca Rolfe with Salt Lake City, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Evelyn Tuddenham with UDOT, thanks to you for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, online voting for a violin prodigy. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. A young violinist from Salt Lake City is competing against seven other musicians for a spot performing with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra next season. So how will the finalists be picked? You decide. Today on the program, we're talking with William Hagen, who joins us to talk about an online competition and his life as a child prodigy. And William joins us by phone from Juilliard School in New York City. And William, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
William Hagen of Salt Lake City is competing to perform next season with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. You can visit our website for a link on how to vote. The voting does end on Monday night. William Hagen, he began playing violin at the age of 4. He's now 19. He studies violin with Itzhak Perlman at the Juilliard School in New York. He's performed as a soloist with many orchestras, including the Utah Symphony, St. Louis Symphony, Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra, and at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And again, he is competing for this spot as a guest soloist with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. If you have questions or comments about the violin, about music, about William Hagen's experience, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. William, you started playing when you were just 4. At what point did you and your parents realize you had a gift?
I always loved the violin. That's why I started it. It's not like my parents forced me to do it. I was begging them for a violin, and I always just liked it. I never assumed that I was any good. And then when I kind of figured that I could maybe do something with it was when I I did a state fair competition when I was 8 years old, and I got to play on Salute to Youth. And that was the most fun I had ever had in my life, going on that stage and playing with the Utah Symphony. So that's when I kind of knew that I wanted to do something more with it than just take lessons.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in Salt Lake City, went to Bonneville Elementary, and eventually to East High School. Starting in the fifth grade, you and your mom would fly to Los Angeles every week so you could continue your lessons. Talk about the commitment you have for music, the passion you have. Where does that come from?
Good question. I've always loved music. I feel like music is a language, and I feel like, you know, we all speak it, but I feel like I've always just kind of felt a connection to classical music. I've been able to understand it, and I've never fallen out of love with playing the violin and with this kind of music.
I want to listen to a clip from your online portfolio. This is a section from Bach Sonata Number 1, Movement Number 4, I believe. Let's take a listen and have you respond to it. William Hagen, how do you approach a piece like this? It's very intricate, very, very nuanced, and very fast.
Mm-hmm. Well, with a piece like that, you can just play the notes, and it'll sound great, you know, because it's so fast. There's so much energy already just in the music. But I feel like what sets apart a good performance and a great performance of a piece like that is being able to find little things to bring out. Little notes to bring out, doing something more with it than just what's on the page.
What do you mean, little things to bring out? The silence, the emphasis that you have on certain notes. What are the little things that make the difference?
Every note is important, but some notes are more important than others in certain situations. And being able to find those notes and bring it out, being able to create a long phrase line so that you keep, you know, it, so that it's more fun to listen to. It's not like something's happening every 2 seconds. You know, you want to have a big build up. I heard a quote from Isaac Stern. He says, always know where you're going and always know where you came from. And I think that's something that it sounds really simple, but it's harder to do when you're playing a million notes, you know? So, and actually knowing where you've come from and where you're going with a piece is, I think, the real challenge.
Well, when you listen to yourself perform, do you hear the glory that the rest of us hear, or are you only hearing the mistakes, you know, the slip-ups that you've made?
It's really funny. I always think that performances have gone a whole lot worse than they actually did. I really don't like listening to myself. When I hear there's a recording of a performance that I've done, I don't like to listen to it because I just, you know, I'm not really interested in it. I feel like, man, maybe I'll listen to a professional recording or something. But things under the ear don't sound quite as good as they do out, you know, with a little bit of space, you know, in the concert hall. So usually I'm a lot happier once I've heard a playback of something that I've done than right after I've done it.
We're speaking with William Hagen. He's been playing the violin since age 4. He's now 19, studying at the Juilliard School in New York, and he's vying for a position as a guest soloist with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, and you can help him do that. You can vote for William Hagen online, but you better hurry. The voting ends at 6 o'clock Monday night, April 30th. There's a link on our website, kcpw.org. William Hagen, you're such a young man, but yet you've studied with some of the greats, including Joseph Silverstein. You're now studying with Itzhak Perlman. What more do you have to learn?
There, a lot, let me tell you. It's, you know, there's knowing how to play the violin, and then there's knowing how to play Beethoven concerto, Beethoven sonatas, you know, certain pieces. You know, once you know how to play the violin, it doesn't mean that you're completely ready. You have to thoroughly learn all the pieces in the repertoire, and that is really hard to do. You know, every piece that I play is still difficult for me. You know, there's no such thing as a real easy piece. I mean, I guess some are harder than others, but it's always, I don't think anybody ever stops learning on the violin. I think that it's always the strive for perfection. And, you know, if I put down the violin for even one day, I feel it the next day. If I don't practice for one day, I feel it the next day. So I guess it's kind of a constant, you know, trying to maintain the level and also learn some more because, you know, I still have so much to learn.
Well, what's a study session like with someone like Itzhak Perlman?
It's usually about an hour-long lesson with him, and I usually go in and play a piece for him, and then he'll listen to it, and he'll you know, pick it apart and tell me things that stuck out to him, things that, you know, I didn't realize when I was playing it that he can point out to me to help me play it better the next time.
Now, violin is not your only love. You played baseball with the Salt Lake Sluggers. You were on the East High varsity team until 10th grade when you had to make somewhat of a difficult choice.
Yeah. I always played, you know, baseball about as much as I played violin. At a certain point, I was out of town so much. It was just kind of rude to the team, you know, if I was gone for practices, if I was gone for games. I mean, I couldn't keep doing it, and it was really hard to stop doing that. I think, you know, at first it was, you know, I kind of accepted that I was going to be able to play baseball, and I kind of, you know, it wasn't a big deal, but then I took my little brother to one of his games. I drove him to a game, and seeing the kids play baseball out there just brought back all these memories, and that was really, really hard for me to see everybody playing baseball, but no.
Did you make the right choice?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I did.
What's it like being at the Juilliard School? I mean, you were a child prodigy. Now you're surrounded by child prodigies. What's that like?
It's an interesting place. It's right in the middle of New York. It's so different from Salt Lake. You know, and everybody told me, oh, it's going to be so different. You know, I'll know what to do. It's New York. It'll be a whole lot of fun. But, you know, it's just a completely different environment. And Juilliard's a funny place where there are so many amazing people that you don't really even, you know, realize. You don't even really realize it. You know, you'll be eating lunch and they'll say, oh, that guy going to Europe, you know, this week to perform. It's just like, you know, it's kind of surprising. But it's a really cool place in that way where, you know, all these amazing people become peers.
Now, you are one of eight young soloists competing for a performance with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra next season. What would this mean for your career?
I think it would be really big because Pittsburgh Symphony is a very famous orchestra. They're a really important orchestra, and a subscription concert is that's a huge deal. That's bigger than playing, you know, a summer concert or something like that. So I think, I mean, obviously, just being able to play Brahms concerto with an orchestra like that would already just be awesome. And then, you know, it can't hurt to put that on your bio.
And what are your future plans? Have you kind of mapped out where you want to be in 10 years or so?
I've always wanted to play concerts. I want to go around the world playing concerts, and so, you know, that's what I'm trying to do with this thing. That's what I want to do, and, you know, it's a lofty goal, but I think I can do it.
Your mom has been using social media in a very active way to try to get voters to vote for you online. Any indication how the voting is going so far?
It's been so overwhelming to see how many people have voted for me. I really haven't liked doing this because I really feel awkward asking people to vote for me. I think it's such an awkward thing, you know, to say, hey, go online and vote for me. But it's just been amazing how many people have stepped up and helped me with it, not just by, you know, voting for me, but also inviting friends to vote for me. It's really been overwhelming. And, I mean, as far as, the, you know, how I think the voting's going, if you look at the YouTube views, I've got a lot more views than the other competitors. So if that's any indication, I think I should be able to get into the next round.
Got a fighting chance. William Hagen of Salt Lake City, now a student at Juilliard. He's competing to perform next season with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. And there's a link on our website, KCPW, if you'd like to help him out. William Hagen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Next time, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Hope you'll join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.